It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, uncertainty for families with kids over the Children's Health Insurance Program, plus lots of questions about insurance options and costs as the new enrollment period nears. Plus, a check-in with the editor of The Incline, the mobile-first news service, as it begins its second year, and what's going to happen with that controversial Stephen Foster statue. That's later in the program. It's been a bit more than 2 weeks since Hurricane Maria ripped across Puerto Rico, devastating the island, knocking out the power grid, leaving people homeless, hospitals with dwindling supplies. In a few minutes, we're going to discuss the longstanding and special bond between Pittsburgh and Puerto Rico and how that relationship is as strong as ever in the wake of the hurricane. But first, we're going to get an update from Puerto Rico from NPR producer Lauren Magaki, who joins us from San Juan. Welcome, Lauren. Lauren, it's been about 2 weeks, a little more than 2 weeks since Hurricane Maria struck. Has there been much change that you've noticed in the about week that you have been? In other words, has there been much progress?
Yeah, I would say so. When I first landed just over a week ago, things were feeling really chaotic. There were hours-long lines, 8 to 12 hours long for gas stations, which people, needed fuel to fill their generators and they needed it to fill their cars. Very, very few communications were working. People hadn't been able to get in touch with their loved ones to tell them that they were okay. Things now are feeling a little bit better. In the capital here, things are moving a lot faster. You see a lot more lights on now. Fuel lines and ATM lines seem almost non-existent, whereas even just a few days ago, that was unheard of.
When you and your NPR colleagues arrived in Puerto Rico, what was the overall plan, the overall approach to your coverage? What questions were you sort of bandying about that would inform your coverage?
Well, one of the really nice things is that I was working here with reporters who spent a lot of time in Puerto Rico far before the storm. Folks like our reporter Greg Allen, who has spent a lot of time here reporting on the debt crisis, and Mandalit Del Barco, who has done a lot of great arts coverage on the island. So we were helicoptering into this disaster, but not into a place that was completely unfamiliar to us. So when we came in, we already had ideas of who we wanted to talk to and what kinds of things had changed. But in a disaster, I feel like one of the main questions you're always just asking immediately is what the heck is going on? We wanted to see for ourselves what was happening outside of the capital. So on our second day, we hopped in the car and just drove as far west as we could get. And you really saw a difference. You saw incredibly long lines for gas, even longer than in the capital. And people who had been completely cut off, they had 8 days after the storm, they had just gotten in touch with loved ones. There's still food lines, grocery stores were closed. Really a much different and a little bit more desperate situation.
You mentioned your colleague, Mandalit Del Barco. She did a story about residents of a barrio on the coast near Old San Juan, just painting signs on wood, SOS, don't forget about us, don't abandon us. That's the essence of some of the stories, because you can talk about numbers and you need to talk about numbers, people without electricity, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the people's stories that are the important ones.
Yeah, and their story is really interesting, even before the storm. It's a neighborhood called La Perla. It was once known for a lot of drugs and crime. It's this really brightly painted neighborhood. All the houses are incredible shades of green and yellow and red. And it's right along the sea in Old San Juan. So they're right in the touristy area. So when they put up these signs saying, Despacito, SOS, we need help, don't forget about us, they knew that they were going to attract some attention. They feel very left behind after the storm. They feel like the Despacito music video opened a lot of doors for them. Tourists were coming by, and they felt like their neighborhood was slowly changing. And now it sort of feels like, they say, many officials haven't come by. They haven't gotten much aid. So I think they're feeling pretty frustrated right now.
On any daily basis, people need health care, and they need treatment. And, of course, that need for care was exacerbated by the hurricane. But I'm curious, what about the situation of the healthcare system itself, the hospitals? Do they have the power and the supplies? Are they getting that to take care of the people?
Well, the governor says that 64 hospitals have been assisted. About 25 of these hospitals, he says, are powered by generators. It's not clear to what degree the generators are functioning. You know, in a place as hot as Puerto Rico, air conditioning is not a luxury. It's a necessity. And we've heard some stories just about patients in rooms that got incredibly hot. You know, you're talking about you're creating a hotbed for germs to spread in that case. And people who have, you know, less pressing problems are pushing them off. I think the governor has stressed quite a bit that they are worried about public health and that that's one of the next things to look out for. The USNS Comfort just arrived this week. It's the floating hospital. They say it can treat 1,000 patients, and it's going to be kind of making the rounds around the island, stopping in different places. So hopefully that will help relieve some of the burden on the hospitals.
President Trump traveled to Puerto Rico Tuesday. Usually visits, attention from a president are welcomed. How was he received, especially after his exchange of comments with the mayor of San Juan?
That's interesting. I think the thing that people were most upset about here was his comparison about the death toll to Katrina. You know, this is a small island, and the president boasting about how the death toll was so low. You know, people here know each other, and those numbers aren't just numbers. People's friends, it's people's family. They, you know, people are likely to know these people. So they were really offended by this comparison, this numbers game that the president was playing. The other thing that people were upset about was just the idea that Puerto Rico's crisis knocked a hole in his budget.
Lauren, in just a minute or two, we're going to be talking about the strong bonds between Pittsburgh and Puerto Rico. And, of course, that was all started by a fan favorite, Roberto Clemente, who, of course, is beloved here and definitely beloved in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, you know, they've got a staging center set up in the Roberto Clemente Coliseum here. It's where the mayor has been sleeping. They're distributing supplies from there. And so his impact is still felt here.
What can we look forward to? What can listeners look forward to from NPR in additional coverage in the aftermath of Maria?
Well, we're here. We've got a whole new team, a fresh batch of reporters on the ground who are out reporting today. Now that sort of the initial crisis has passed, we're sort of digging into more enterprising stories and kind of trying to do a little bit more truth squatting and figuring out what's really happening behind some of these numbers and some of the things that people are telling us. You know, what does it take to get an entire electrical grid back online? How do we figure out death counts when, you know, certain cities haven't even been accessed yet? The story is not going away for a long time, and we'll be here to report it.
Lauren Migaki is a producer for NPR. She joined us from Puerto Rico. Lauren, thanks so much for spending some time.
Thank you.
Pittsburgh has had a long and strong relationship with Puerto Rico ever since Pirate fans fell in love with a young player, an eventual Hall of Famer by the name of Roberto Clemente. 45 years after Clemente's death, that relationship seems to be as strong as ever. Let's talk about those ties with Diana Nelson-Jones, a reporter, columnist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Diana. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Your comments and questions are welcome. Tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. So, Diana, for anybody who doesn't know, give us a little brief history lesson. How did Pittsburgh and Puerto Rico become so connected?
Well, I do think that it was Clemente. And his earlier years were not as smooth as some of his later ones. I mean, I remember reading when I was a kid about how sports reporters made fun of the way he talked. And,
right.
And he was considered arrogant and proud because he was proud. Mm-hmm. And yet, I think the average fan, you talk to any baseball fan in Pittsburgh and ask if they're of a certain age, they all gush over their admiration for him as a player. And then, of course, you know, when we began to find out how much he did off the field to help others, not just his famous last flight, but many, many before that, things he did that were not publicized that began coming to light. I think Pittsburghers are the kind of people who love, who appreciate and do, you know, pitch in and show up to help. And I think that that bond was stronger when he died because we found out that he was doing the kind of thing that Pittsburghers really, you know, I think feel that we do well. And so for me personally, I mean, it's one of the reasons why I wanted to end up living in the city, because I would come as a kid with my family.
From where?
From Shinston, West Virginia.
Oh, my goodness.
2 hours south. It was 3 hours before the interstate. And we came up for ball games. And I fell in love with him and the way he played and everything about him. And I knew that my connection to Pittsburgh, he helped me with my connection to Pittsburgh. So there's that.
So you alluded to his tragic death 45 years ago this December 31st. It'll be 45 years. Of course, he organized a relief effort for earthquake-stricken Nicaragua, was on board and turned out to be an overloaded cargo plane. So he was doing humanitarian work, and of course that cargo plane went down. Did that cement that relationship? People thought well of him. They appreciated him as a ball player, but they even more appreciated him as a human being.
Oh yeah, I believe so. I mean, it was really almost like a martyrdom. There are some people who are talking about elevating him to sainthood, which I think is just a deplorable, terrible thing to do to a human being as flawed and wonderful as he was. He was a human being who died, mm-hmm. and he died doing something nobody else I can think of would do on New Year's Eve.
Yeah. We spoke earlier with Roberto Clemente Jr. There's been a lot of relief efforts, obviously, you allude to, and we're going to talk a little bit more about. Roberto Jr. was working with Brothers Brother Foundation and the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. We asked him about his humanitarianism, why it's important to him and not just toward Puerto Rico. He pointed to his parents. He said it was in his genes.
That's how we were raised. I mean, that's the culture of our family. And that's how I grew up. That's the only thing that we know how to do, is actually to give and help when help is needed.
Hmm. Yeah. So giving back. And again, it's not just toward Puerto Rico. I mean, because it's easy to give back toward your homeland, where you were born, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It's that spirit to help out people that you don't even know.
Right. I mean, I really do think that it's like when people talk about, you know, what is going to save the human race. It's going to be, you know, making connections to other people, no matter where they're from, making sure that you're always available, you know, that you are willing and available to be of some assistance to somebody else, no matter where they live or where they're from.
Were writing about people visiting the Clemente Museum for their donation open house. What did you hear from people?
Last Saturday, it was amazing. I got there within the first hour of a 7-hour open house that was very brilliantly tied to getting into the museum for $21. That was the number that Roberto wore. And you could get into the museum, and that was your donation to the relief effort. So the Clemente Museum had its own relief effort that it tied in with Carlos Beltran, who is a player for the Astros. He's Puerto Rican, and so they're doing something through him. There were 150 people through the door within the first 40 minutes. And the place was swarming by midday.
Now, were you going as a fan or were you going as a reporter? And what did people tell you?
I went to take a contribution and thinking this would be a great way for me to write a column to get the word out that not only is today the day that people can come to the museum, but they can also donate online at theclementemuseum.org.
Okay. Now, as I said, lots of relief efforts. I understand that Global Links is collecting non-motorized wheelchairs tomorrow that will make their way to Puerto Rico. And, of course, yesterday, former pirate players, they arrived in San Juan with 500,000 pounds of food, water, and other essentials that were collected over 2 days in Pittsburgh. Let's hear from Joey Cora, a Pirates coach and a native of Puerto Rico.
We didn't know there were so many Puerto Ricans here in Pittsburgh. They are. And when they come through that line donating stuff and telling you that they haven't been able to communicate with anybody in Puerto Rico, they just donating stuff. Whether they're going to get to their parents or their families, they don't know.
So many Puerto Ricans in Pittsburgh, but I bet you it was a lot more than Puerto Ricans outside that Clemente Museum.
I think traffic was backed up. My workplace is near there, and it was kind of a madhouse. People wanting to be part of something larger, and I think, you know, the way I put it was sort of like, if for no other reason than now, let the spirit of Clemente infuse your spirit with giving. And I think, you know, that's what I saw happen. In those 2 days when the Pirates were collecting.
We have just about a minute left, and I wanted to ask you: do you think it's just this outpouring is just part of the natural generosity of this region, or is it something special because of Clemente and the ties to Puerto Rico?
I think it's both. I think that there's a natural generosity in Pittsburgh. I've never been anywhere like this for that kind of response. But Clemente was just sort of like the extra, you know, horsepower for our caring. It's like we wanted to be him. You know, we wanted to be like him.
Yes, we did have people of a certain age, both whether we wanted to be ball players or just people like Roberto
That's
Clemente.
Right.
So you mentioned, we're just about out of time, you mentioned that this relief effort's going to be going on for a long time because the devastation is widespread. People can still help out?
Yes, and it's even going to be beyond the relief effort. I mean, what I think they need to do long term is to really think about infrastructure on the island. I mean, you know, the Caribbean islands' infrastructure isn't really good, and they're the ones who are going to be plowed and over and over again with all this, the rising seas.
Diana Nelson-Jones is a reporter and columnist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks so much, Diana.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a new insurance enrollment period begins in a few weeks, and Congress missed a deadline to extend the Children's Health Insurance Program. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Republican U.S. Congressman Tim Murphy will resign later this month following reports the anti-abortion politician asked a woman he had an affair with to consider getting her own abortion when he thought she was pregnant. He originally said he would retire at the end of his term. And hundreds of counter-protesters gathered in Oakland to drown out demonstrations by members of the controversial Westboro Baptist Church. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Questions abound here in Pittsburgh as well as around the nation about health insurance. Congress this past weekend failed to renew the Children's Health Insurance Program, which covers 9 million kids nationwide. Plus, Graham Cassidy, the latest Republican plan to repeal and replace Obamacare, didn't generate enough support for a formal vote. All this as a new enrollment period for health insurance begins in 26 days. We're going to talk about all of that with Laura Olson, Washington-based reporter for The Morning Call. Welcome back, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And in studio, two reporters from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette who've been covering health insurance access for children, for adults, Kate Giamarisi and Chris Mamula. Welcome, Kate and Chris.
My pleasure.
And you are welcome to join the conversation. Tweet us your comments or questions, and please use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, let's start with what some of us thought might be the easier one, bipartisan support for extending CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. Why didn't it get extended? Let's start with, Laura, let's start with you.
Well, yeah, as you said, this was a little bit of a surprise because this program really has enjoyed bipartisan support for a long time. There was a deal actually announced in mid-September by the top Democrat and Republican on the Senate panel that is in charge of crafting the CHIP bill in that chamber, saying, hey, we've got an agreement, we'll be able to move forward. And shortly after that, we saw the latest effort on repealing Obamacare start over again, and a lot of healthcare-related legislation kind of ground to a halt. I think Kate and Chris had written about this as well, but there are a few other healthcare-related programs that got stuck in limbo, and CHIP was one of them. So it did get things stuck. We won't really see an impact in Pennsylvania for a little bit. State officials say that they can keep the program running there until February with the amount of funding that they have available. But that starts to get a little bit tricky once we move later and later into the fall.
Yeah, we're going to hear from the Acting Secretary for Human Services, Teresa Miller, in just a minute or so. But Kate, I wanted to get you to chime in.
Well, yeah, Laura did an excellent job of explaining that, you know, the advocates I spoke to felt that they were on track to see this program renewed, you know, before the funding expired, but that was derailed by the last unsuccessful Obamacare repeal effort.
So is there any movement on Congress on CHIP? Are they separating the two? Are they folding the CHIP into the big picture? What are we hearing?
Well, so my understanding, and perhaps Laura can add to this, but there's two separate bills now, one in the House, one in the Senate, that have both been moving forward. I don't know really that there is a consensus, but both bills would extend the program for another 5 years. And the advocates that I've spoken to are hopeful that this, you know, can get done soon. And they do say that it is on Congress's agenda. But, you know, the fact, though, that the bills aren't exactly the same and that there is a little bit of partisan wrangling, you know, that's why they had wanted this to get done prior to the end of September when the funding runs out.
Laura, is that your understanding?
Yeah, and on Wednesday, as Kate said, we did start to see those bills move forward. There were committees in the House and the Senate that voted to start pushing them to the floor, but they're not exactly the same. Both of them, I believe, would start to undo a funding boost that occurred under the Affordable Care Act, and so the funding would be back to what it was before that law, though the states would have a couple of years to adjust and to plan for any changes in funding. But we still might see some changes. We also heard in committee from Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, who had some concerns about how some of the funding that's been allocated for the program that isn't used by states, he said some of that has gone to other purposes in the budget to plug budget holes. Not that it has been diverted away from the program, but it was approved to be used for CHIP. The states didn't need that much, and he says it's being used for other purposes. So we may see a couple of other budget-related fights unfold as the debate gets to the floor.
I mentioned I talked with Pennsylvania's Acting Secretary for Human Services, Teresa Miller, earlier this week, and she says Pennsylvania would be able to sustain CHIP for a few months without federal help.
Ultimately, if we had to shut this program down, it would be a few months from now, and we would send 30-day notices to recipients that the program would be shutting down.
But my understanding is some other states might have to take action not as good a shape as Pennsylvania's CHIP program.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, this is a program that's jointly operated by the states and the federal government and jointly funded. And yeah, as Secretary Miller explained, you know, we are okay for a few months in Pennsylvania, and, you know, that people shouldn't necessarily panic about their children's coverage. And that's, again, why the state hasn't, you know, notified people about this yet. But yes, as you said, there are some other states that their funding would run out more quickly, or that they have even said that they might very soon have to take steps to curtail enrollment or even, you know, start shutting the program down in a couple months if Congress doesn't act.
Laura, are you hearing in Washington some officials from some of these states that might be in a little bit more trouble with their CHIP program saying, hey, get something done?
Yeah, there's, I believe it's about three states that would run out of money by the end of the year, and then that number starts to quickly grow as we get into 2018. So obviously they've raised some concerns. One other snag that, a bureaucratic snag for Pennsylvania, is that advocates say that the state program needs to be reauthorized by the end of the year, and that's kind of a bureaucratic step, but if you don't know how much money is coming from the federal government for a state or a jointly state and federal run and paid for program, it's hard to start to write the legislation that state lawmakers will need to write to plan how the program is going to go forward at the state level.
And all of this while there are still many questions abounding about access to health insurance in general. I mentioned earlier that a new enrollment program begins November 1st. So, Chris Mamula, I want to bring you into the conversation. What are you hearing about uncertainty, questions, whether it's from consumers or even insurers? What have you been following?
Well, the biggest thing is that the uncertainty in the funding, and this is something I'd like to ask Laura a little bit about to see what she's heard, but continuing questions about the funding is driving up rates. It causes turmoil in the market. The market hates uncertainty. So we're seeing Highmark, for example, seeking an ACA, you know, Affordable Care Act rates increase of 20%. Now, we won't know if the insurance department is going to grant that until the middle of October. But it's still it's a symptomatic. It reflects the uncertainty over the continuing funding. So, and I'm not exactly sure where that is at. I mean, it sounds like it's gone back and forth a couple times. The president has been kind of uncertain about it also. So I don't know. I'm less clear about that.
Laura?
Unfortunately, I don't think I can offer a lot of clarity at the moment down here. Before the latest push in the Senate to undo the Affordable Care Act, there had been hearings at the beginning of September with governors, state insurance commissioners, including an official from Pennsylvania, who were coming down to say, okay, how can we stabilize the market? What should we be doing? And we heard from those state officials saying, hey, give us some more flexibility, give us some certainty on the payments that are coming. And as that effort was moving forward, then there was the renewed push to really make some more dramatic changes to really overhaul Obamacare. And so that effort got put on hold after the latest push then failed. We heard from those the Democrats and Republicans who lead that committee saying, okay, we're going to try again to reach a deal. We'll see if we can do something to help stabilize the market. But so far, they really haven't been able to come to an agreement.
Secretary Miller testified before, I believe it was the Senate Finance Committee, just days before Graham Cassidy failed to generate enough support. And she had testified earlier than that before the Senate Health Committee. The secretary says the insurance markets must get stabilized and that she believes that will help ease some of the uncertainty otherwise.
Because right now, states are finalizing rate for plans for 2018. And without a bill to stabilize the market, I think it's possible you could see companies exit the market entirely because they're just fed up with all the uncertainty. I think what we'll see is certainly much higher rates here in Pennsylvania and around the country than we would otherwise see.
I think she's exactly right about the uncertainty that's been injected into the market. I don't think there's any threat, any possibility really of either Highmark or UPMC Health Plan locally bailing out of the market. They've given no indication. In fact, it's been the opposite. Both insurers, and they are the dominant insurers in Western Pennsylvania, have said that they're in it for the long run.
So Secretary Miller also said that, now I believe we lost two insurers in the past year. So I believe we have five in Pennsylvania, but it's not like people in Pittsburgh have five choices. There's five across Pennsylvania total, and I think it ranges a choice of one to a maximum of a choice of three. So can it get any tighter here? Laura, then Chris?
Yeah, in the Lehigh Valley region, we have three insurance companies that are offering plans on the individual market. And you could see it get a little bit tighter. That's an option. But so far, I think what we heard from the insurance commissioner was at least if there's some sort of calm from Congress that the insurers weren't expecting to see a rate increase that was going to be more than like 8 or 9%. If we see more of a push down here to really continue shaking things up, then we might see more concerns from those insurers.
By comparison, I don't think Western Pennsylvania has that. I don't think these two big players, Highmark and UPMC Health Plan, have any plans to pull out. There are counties in the country that are going bare, just to have no insurer. And that's an issue. That's a problem. But it's not here. In fact, in the Affordable Care Act, we actually have an Affordable Care coverage. The Obamacare coverage, we actually have a new carrier, Centene, which has entered the market recently. So it's not an issue locally. Other parts of the country, yes, it definitely is.
So there's a lot of talk about stabilizing markets, and one way might be with this sort of bolstering and assuring the future of cost-sharing reduction payments. Explain, what is that? What are we talking about?
Yeah, that's the subsidies that are paid to insurers to as part of to keep rates down, basically. And it's
how does that help the consumer?
Well, those reductions are passed along to the consumer. They would pay less as a result.
For their copay, their deductible?
No, it's actually for their premiums.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's, you bring up an interesting point. The thing about the, it's not, it's something that we feel and we notice in our paychecks, but we don't often talk about the amount that employees are having to pick up in paying for their health insurance is up dramatically, 65% between 2005 and 2015, according to one study. 65% is huge. I mean, that's in the form of copays and deductibles. In the same period of time, wages have only increased 30%. So, and we know from Kaiser that this is the default way that companies, most health insurance is provided by employers, and this is the way that most companies deal with rising insurance costs. They pass it along. So we can expect, as individuals, we can expect higher to pay more.
Laura, is that what insurance companies are looking for, some sort of guarantee that these cost-sharing reduction payments will be guaranteed, I should say, over the course of many months or a year or two? And would that help stabilize the market?
Because right now what we're seeing is that the administration has really only promised to pay for them month by month, and we've heard a couple of different threats from the administration to say, nope, we're not going to pay those anymore. They still have continued to pay them, but if you're running a business and you're not sure if these funds are going to keep coming in, it makes it really hard to plan. And so that's one of the things we keep hearing over and over again, is that if those payments really need to have some certainty to them.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Laura. It forces insurers to develop rates that are based on the worst case scenario. Like, geez, we're not sure if we're going to have this source of funding, so we're going to have to set the rates much higher just in case. So, yeah, it's a great deal of uncertainty to push into the market.
We have just a few minutes left, and Kate, I want to bring you in back into the conversation, because we're talking a lot about numbers, and numbers are important. How many insurers are available, what rates, what percentage they might go up, et cetera, et cetera. But what are the stories? What are you hearing? What is the messaging that you're hearing from people about CHIP or in health insurance in general?
Well, I mean, obviously, people who have health insurance for their children want to continue to have it. And just to throw out some numbers, that is 176,000 children in Pennsylvania who are covered under the CHIP program.
So they're unsure? When is this going to stop? When will it stop? You know, is this just a threat? You know, will it get renewed in time? You hearing that?
Well, I mean, obviously, because it's now been in the news more because of Congress having failed to act by the deadline. Yeah, I have seen some people that are concerned, and because of course, yeah, they are uncertain about what does it mean for their family and for their child.
Right. In our remaining 2 minutes, I want to ask you each what you'll be following. What are the questions that you want answers to? What are you going to expect to be reporting on in the days and weeks ahead? And let's start with you, Kate.
Well, so obviously we want to continue to pay attention to what is Congress going to act on CHIP funding, and also there's some other programs related to healthcare that they failed to act on by the end of September, such as the home visitor program and also funding for federally qualified health centers. So we'll be paying attention to that.
All right. And we're going to have to end it right there. Kate Giammarese is a reporter. Giammarese is a reporter for the Post-Gazette, as is Chris Mamula. And thanks to Laura Olson, reporter for The Morning Call. It's The Confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, George Romero's Night of the Living Dead premieres at the Fulton Theater, now called the Byam, in 1968. Much of the zombie horror film was shot in Evan City, just north of Pittsburgh. Its reception was controversial at first, with many finding the gory special effects off-putting, but it's since been recognized as a classic and a staple in the genre. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for October 6, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Recently, The Incline, the mobile-first news site, marked its first anniversary of, as its website says, connecting readers with relevant news about Pittsburgh and driving civic engagement through events. In studio is Lexi Belcufine. She's the editor of The Incline. Welcome, Lexi.
Thank you so much for having me, Kevin.
All right, so connecting readers with relevant news about Pittsburgh. That relevant news can come from Incline reporters, but also other sources, Post-Gazette, Next Pittsburgh, City Paper, Public Source, etc. Has that mix of original reporting by your reporters and the aggregated stories from other sources, has it changed during the course of the year or not?
Certainly. So at The Incline, we do have a staff of 3 staff reporters and an editor, myself, and a food and culture editor as well. And over the past year, we found a really great model in doing original journalism, but also curating. We don't aggregate, and we do try and set that apart. What we do is we actually link out to Public Source or WESA or the Post-Gazette. We believe that our audience is most important. And so if there's an important story happening in the city, we want to connect our readers to it. And so if you click on that link on the website, it takes you directly to the Post-Gazette or the Tribune Review, or from a social media site. If we're linking to a Public Source, it'll take you straight there.
It doesn't matter so much who does the story, but sharing with your readers, with your consumers.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's important for us, too. We're vetting all of these stories. So we're helping people connect with the story that day that is most important. Sometimes there's 5 versions of a story, but we want people to know that when they find it through us, that we've read all the stories already and that it is the best version. And, you know, in a world of fake news, we're trying to be a, you know, a springboard for people to news that they can count on.
In those early days, what kind of stories were you most interested in presenting and sharing with the Pittsburgh community?
One of our missions is connecting with a younger audience, and that's just because our website is optimized for mobile. So if you're on our website online, it doesn't make a ton of sense. When I say online, desktop.
Right.
But when you're on your mobile device, your phone, it makes a ton of sense. It's super easy to navigate. It's fast. And so for us, we're trying to keep in mind who is the audience that is connecting there. You know, do they need a traffic report? Probably not, because they've gotten that on Twitter. But do they need to know a cool event to do over their lunch break or during happy hour? Yes. So we'll try and connect people in those ways.
So was there a gap in the coverage to that the younger audience might be interested in, say, hey, what about us?
Sure. I mean, this is a really competitive and great media market to be a part of. And, you know, what we were finding, though, was that there were stories that were important. There were stories that were being told. And there are a lot of stories that we try to tell that are connecting people to the city and allowing them to better utilize the city. So one of the stories that we did in during the primary was a procrastinator's guide to the primary. We rounded up all of the candidates and we laid it out in a format that was easy to read and quick and fast, because what we know is that voters need that information, and so we wanted to make it accessible.
You came from one of those other sources, the Post-Gazette. What drew you to this venture, a different way of presenting news and stories and sharing them?
So I had been admiring Billy Penn from across the state for 2 years. Billy Penn was our company's first city-specific site. They're in Philadelphia. They launched in October 2014. And for me, it was so exciting to see a news organization trying something completely different, a different way of telling stories and sharing stories. And so also trying to find that revenue model that's super important to what we're doing. And that's, you know, we depend on a little bit of advertising on the website, but that slows us down. And so instead, we rely on sponsorships, partnerships, and we are going to be launching a membership model soon, which will be great. We know that local journalism has never been more important, and so we're trying to make sure that that lives on.
In terms of content or public reception of The Incline, any surprises during this first year?
It's amazing how many people have told us that they love us and that they needed us. And oftentimes they didn't know that. But now that we're here, they're really into what we're doing and into the way that we're trying to do things. People love our morning newsletter. And, you know, it's 5 quick stories in the morning, an event. It's everything you need to know about Pittsburgh in 5 minutes. And so being able to provide new products for people that they really have connected to has been a huge surprise for us.
How do you measure success completely for the organization in terms of your original reporting, in terms of how you're being received, in terms of
sponsorships and now memberships. How do you measure the success of the whole package?
Influence in the city, the same that all journalists measure their impact, right? I mean, it's a matter of, does our audience feel connected with us? Do they really love getting their morning newsletter? Do they open it with zeal? And then on the flip side too, you know, are we contributing to the conversation through our original reporting that is having an impact on the city and that's helping people access the city in a way that they couldn't before? And you know, a success for a startup too means financial viability. And so we're working on all of those things every day.
You, The Incline, co-hosted with WESA a mayoral forum in May. Any stories, any projects during the first year of The Incline that you're particularly proud of?
Certainly. So the debate and the primary, the Procrastinator's Guide to the Primary were two of our things in the spring that we were really excited about. We've broken numerous stories about self-driving cars. We recently partnered with the HuffPost, the national news organization, on a project about self-driving cars, and we're a part of their Listen to America tour. They were in Pittsburgh just last week. And we also have a series called Who's Next? And through that series, we're able to highlight under 40 Pittsburghers who are doing cool things to make the city better. And these aren't the people that are in the headlines today, but these are the people that we think will be shaping decisions tomorrow and that you need to know today.
The Incline is a mobile-first news service, so how important is social media to what you do in generating content and then providing those stories?
So as evidenced by the events we throw and the types of story we write, we really try to exist where people are. We try to bring the news to where people are at as opposed to having them seek it out. And so what we know about news consumers is that they get their news on Facebook or they get it on Twitter. And so hopefully when you see the little orange Incline logo next to a story, you know that it's a story that you should read and it's a story that's relevant to you today. And so, you know, we're on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat. And when the next social media site comes out, we'll be there too, because we think that our audience deserves to have a news organization that wants to talk to them in those places.
How, if at all, have your goals for year two changed from year one?
So in year two, we're looking to host a lot more events. And so we hope that people will come. And, you know, these are events that are sometimes news related, but often just, you know, events to help people connect with each other, network, access the city in a different way, volunteer. So another one of our goals in year two is getting into different neighborhoods and covering different neighborhoods. So, you know, we want to make sure that we're connecting with audiences across the city and even in, you know, the north and south suburbs. We want to get into the East Hills. We want to make sure that we're really connecting with and making, you know, giving people a way to connect with their region in a new way. And so for us, you know, we feel like in year one, we've found success in our journalism. And in year two, we're just really doubling down on our membership and events model.
Lexi Belkufine is the editor of The Incline, starting its second year. Congratulations. Good luck. And thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Around in Pittsburgh for 117 years, including the last 73 in Schenley Park, but many people think it's time to go. Let's get an update on the fate of the statue of composer, father of American folk music, and Pittsburgh native Stephen Foster from WESA social justice reporter Virginia Alvino Young. Welcome, Virginia.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks.
For those who haven't seen it, please describe this controversial statue.
Yeah, it's very conspicuously placed along a pathway in Schenley Park, and it's 10-foot-tall bronze sculpture on a 4-foot-tall granite pedestal, and it's Stephen Foster holding a parchment that used to have a pen in his hand, and he's, you know, looking like he's composing music, and the controversy comes in with the figure that's at his feet. It is a black man who is shoeless and playing the banjo. Many see this man as being a caricature of an African-American slave. The rest of the controversy comes in when he is playing the banjo music that Stephen Foster looks like he is appropriating and writing as his own piece.
This controversy arises from time to time, but it seems to have really intensified since this summer's incident in Charlottesville.
Yeah, as the conversation nationally, the dialogue really grew around Confederate monuments, people were sort of looking here at home as, you know, what's problematic right here in our own backyard.
The Pittsburgh Arts Commission has been soliciting public input online as well as the public hearing Wednesday evening.
Online, there was a near consensus that they had 126 pieces of input. Most of those were either in the categories of remove, relocate, or alter the statue, but there were about 30 people who said, you know, don't do anything. Those were of the online commenters. But the vast majority of those folks who showed up in person to testify were in favor of removing or relocating it. There were about 4 people, I believe, who justified the statue where it is and were sort of speaking to the merits of Stephen Foster as to why it should stay in place.
Including Marshall Goodwin.
Yeah, he basically says, yeah, it's cultural appropriation. It's been happening for a long time where white musicians get credit for the music of black musicians who are there inspired by. He had a whole long list of rock and roll musicians and gospel musicians, not sort of getting the credit that they deserve. But he also said, you know, it can be a good thing that, you know, music brings people together.
I don't see this as personally as racist. I never even noticed Stephen Foster. It's this wonderful man with a smile on his face through the worst adversity making this joyous sound.
Virginia, I understand that there were some suggestions about having a plaque.
Some people are pro-plaque, but that's not a huge portion of people that are weighing in here. They're saying at least it's something, again, to give it some context. But a lot of people are saying, no, that's not enough. The imagery is so bold. And so, you know, the fact that it's in public, that you can just see it walking by, it's not enough to sort of overwrite the problematic nature of the piece itself.
Including Dolores Dupree. Who is she?
She is a leader of the National Council of Negro Women, speaking on behalf of a large regional group here in southwestern Pennsylvania, who said just that.
Not only does it depict a white man in a dominant, oppressive posture over a black man portrayed as a slave, but it boldly represents this same white man unabashedly claiming the black man's work as his own. We contend that our children do not need to be constantly bombarded with demeaning images of the troubling history of our oppression.
One of the powerful comments I heard from your reporting was from Billy Heilman.
Billy is just a guy. He was like, I'm not, you know, there are a lot of really great academic testimonies, right? People giving a lot of history on both sides. Billy says he's just a guy that has seen the statue forever and hates it.
And this statue clearly sends the message of what white people will and continue to steal from black people, including their freedom, their lives, their music, their culture. That's what that statue means to me. I don't want to be a part of it, and I don't want my city to be a part of it.
Virginia, for some people, the statue represents history, for some, racism, but we're also talking about public art. What that is and what it should represent. And that's part of the debate here, isn't it?
That, for a lot of people, is the debate. Even the people who are the most avid protesters of having it where it's at are not denying the merits of Stephen Foster. But what they're saying is that this is not about Stephen Foster and that it doesn't actually portray history because of the way that it portrays the African-American in the piece. They're saying that's not true to life. What it portrays is the way that people a century ago viewed African-Americans. So really the debate for a lot of people, including our experts at the city level, are saying that this is about what we value as a city. This is about how we publicly represent ourselves. And if we're supposed to be marketing ourselves to new businesses and new people coming here as a progressive, welcoming city, is this really what we want to be displaying as representative of those values?
So what's next for the debate over this statue and the statue itself?
People still have time to go to the city's Art Commission website and give their public input. There's another public hearing on Wednesday, October 25th. After that, although city code does say that there needs to be a 2/3 vote by the commission to remove or relocate or alter city art, they are going to make a recommendation to Mayor Bill Peduto. He will be taking that recommendation as well as public input, and he'll be the one making the final decision.
Virginia Alvino Young is WESA's social justice reporter. Thanks, Virginia.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley. The assistant producer is Katie Blackley. Production assistants from Courtney Harrell. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.